Nobody cares what it's about. Who the hell is this to zombie takeout anyway?
And welcome to episode 400 of Zombie Takeout, the B-Moving Cult Movie Show. I'm John.
And I'm Scotto.
And I typically don't say the episode number since we went to YouTube, but I figured this time I really should, because again, 400.
Four damn hundred episodes.
Would have been here in the summer, but you know, extenuating circumstances.
Oh my god.
But that's a good thing because it allowed me to find this week's movie, which we'll get to, but we do have a little bit of listener submitted first, or feedback. Patrick Leaney II on Facebook, on the trailer for this week's movie, said, congrats on the 400th episode.
Thank you, Patrick.
And Bodo left us a voicemail.
John Scotto, Bodo. Congratulations on the big 400. I was not able to watch the movie. I'm sure you may have already recorded your review of it, but love you guys. You guys are the best. And hopefully we can be around for 400 more. Might take 10 and a half years, but maybe we'll get there eventually. Love you guys. You guys are the best. Bye.
This it was tough getting this one together, honestly.
Yeah, I don't know about the 400 more thing. considering it took us a decade to get here.
It did, didn't it? Yeah. My God, 10 years to do 400 episodes, but, you know.
Well, that's with the 4-month hiatus like recently, and I think if I recall, we took like a better part of a year off in 2009 after my computer went belly up.
Oh, yeah. I moved a couple, well, and I'm about to do so again.
Yeah, but we're also facing another little hiatus, probably not 4 months. Do we just want to say this is it for the year, or do we want to risk it and maybe try to get one more out?
If we can get the wherewithal to get something together next month, we sure as hell will try, but... Yeah.
There is a good chance this will be it for the year.
Yeah, I'd say it's a good chance that we, unfortunately, cannot do more this year.
Which is kind of okay because Bandmaid's coming out on December 11th, which is a Wednesday, the new Bandmaid album. By the way, and this is a hearing thing, but I'll just mention, their latest single was produced by Tony Visconti.
Cool.
Bowie's producer.
Yeah.
Wow. But yeah, their album's coming out on a Wednesday, and that would be difficult for me. And, you know, the new Star Wars is coming out on a Thursday. I already got tickets for it. So, yeah, it might be best if we don't do anything next month. Anyway, finally, without any further ado, on to this week's movie, which is from 1974, Phantom of the Paradise. And, of course, that brings us to the impromptu plot summary, sponsored by the Juicy Fruits. When Sean and I aren't quite annoying enough, get the Juicy Fruits.
I think Wrigley's gonna sue. And also brought to you by Brian De Palma's Time Machine. Want to find out what's going to happen in the world of music for the next 20 years? Take a ride in Brian De Palma's Time Machine.
Oh, yeah. In addition to what we were discussing, which we'll get to, I think he also may have invented goth.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I was kind of on the fence about this movie until the undeads came on. And then my brain's fucking just hit the back window here.
Yeah. I had already bought the movie by that point.
All right. So we pretty much have a telling of the Phantom of the Opera. Well, we have this plucky songwriter who's really earnest. You kind of think he's like an Elton John type of person. I almost thought he was Warren Zevon himself.
Or maybe a bad Ray Charles impression that went on way too long.
Yeah. And he's playing his singer-songwriter stuff, and this is about the time of Elton John, so I think I definitely
certainly a factor, and Jimmy Webb, and not Leanne Redbone. There's Leon Russell. Mm. There's a lot of guys, piano player, singers types that they borrowed from.
Take some Leon Redbone, or anyway. there is, of course, the evil impresario. By the name of Swan, who hears him doesn't like his look or his, I don't know what he doesn't like about him exactly, but
he's just not marketable.
Yeah, he's just not marketable. So he, you know, which is kind of absurd because, of course, what is marketable at the time?
Yeah,
but Elton John.
This is before MTV.
Piano. But anyway, he decides that he could take this music and market it much better, and so he steals it, and he quote unquote auditions women, and of course that's where we meet our ingenue Phoenix, who they were rather impressed by her dance moves for some reason, which is kind of funny. I'm like,
well, I think they were mostly impressed with her voice, which legitimately was good, but
yes,
yeah, the physical part of her performance.
So she's of course going to be the next big thing, and this songwriter will not give up. He's trying to get credit or get at least this done decently or to his standards, but he keeps getting pushed away more and more violently until he is arrested. And but fear not. Sing Sing is a place one can escape from easily.
After they pull your teeth out to make sure you don't get any infections.
Yeah. And when he does escape, he goes to destroy the record pressing plant. And that is where his terrible disfigurement that we know, that the fans
incident
known for happens.
Yeah.
When he comes out, he grabs some costume, a metal helmet, black cape, and some black leather, and we tend to hear him breathing a lot through it.
And there ends up being this black box on his chest.
Yeah.
This movie, again, was 74.
Yeah, that is, as you watch this movie, and, you know, first, you know, it's not good, you know, and you're thinking, huh, this is rough. Then you realize, wait a minute, this was 1974. This is before Star Wars.
Mm-hmm. Before Star Wars,
and there are
before the Rocky Horror Picture Show, the movie anyway. Before Bauhaus.
And I tell you, they go into like Swan's domain, and if you didn't think, you know, I mean, the white and black light that's used, you kind of start thinking you're on the Death Star for a bit in some scenes. He is now the Phantom, of course. The Paradise is the park that Swan is looking to open up course, this...
You said park.
Right.
We don't want to be reminded of Phantom of the Park.
I thought it was... is that what I'm thinking of? I'm thinking of Phantom of the Park.
So it was a music hall, a theater, whatever you want to call it.
Okay, all right. So it was a theater, and he was looking to open it with this new ingenue. Actually, no. He decides to, because the Phantom wants this woman to sing his stuff, he decides to be spiteful and find pretty much literally a meathead named Beef to sing this stuff for him, and to just take whatever license you want with it. I think he was digging at Robert Plant. Do you?
Oh yeah, of course. And Beef also, maybe Meatloaf.
Yeah, that was the weird thing too. Was Meatloaf really Meatloaf before that?
That's what I was wondering. Also, the Paradise Theater, that caught my attention because I actually do like Styx, and you know they'd have an album called Paradise Theater. There's actually a theater in Chicago called the Paradise Theater, apparently. Or there was.
There may have been. Yeah. He had a lot of big theaters here.
So that just happened to catch my attention for the Styx reference.
Long before Styx, too, though, isn't it?
Before the album. The album was 71. I think the band's been together since like the early 70s, late 60s.
You know, I did not know Styx were together for that long.
Yeah. They formed in like the late 60s. Beef was basically the typical glam rock guy. I double checked New York Dolls. They actually got together in 71.
Yeah.
So, and Bolan around the same year kind of started glam rock. So He was a few years into glam rock, but that's still pretty early for a movie to be featuring it.
Well, honestly, it kind of was peaking at around this year.
Like, yeah, he was in just at the right time.
Yeah. So
usually movies are a little bit late to that.
The Phantom, of course, threatens Beef with his life to not sing his songs. And Beef does the understandable, logical thing.
Runs
by,
away.
I'm getting out of here. But of course, the Swan has some muscle that, that of course, convinces him to stay. His faithful sidekick, Philbin. And who resembles Meatloaf an awfully lot.
Yeah, I think Eddie's appearance in the movie was borrowed from Philbin, at least early in the film.
Well, there's the whole rockabilly thing that both of them were going on. But then again, and it's funny because I thought that the opening Rod Sterling thing was just an impression of Rod
Sterling. It's actually Sterling.
I couldn't believe that it really was him. Yeah. And but it talks about just this nostalgia wave and just the whole 50s nostalgia thing back then was just overwhelming.
Well, if you think about it, it was only 20 years earlier. 15,
right.
Really.
Right.
It would be like us being nostalgic for the 90s. Which
right.
We kind of are. If you're of that age, you are nostalgic for your 20s, teens. You know,
but we are nowhere near as nostalgic about the 90s as they were about the 60s and 50s back in the 80s and 70s. Mm-hmm. I mean, think about the most watched show or some of the most watched shows Wonder in the Years. 70s, you know, Happy Days.
Yeah. And I was then, thinking 60s with Wonder Years, but yeah.
And then in the 80s, you had the Wonder Years.
Right.
And in the 90s, you had that 70s show, but that really wasn't like a... Nah. As big a show as, you know, Happy Days.
Mm-hmm. That's a
Happy
good
Days
point.
Was
yeah.
Fucking
the 50s thing in the 70s was a little over the top.
And you had everybody working a 50s angle into their act, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Bowie and Elton John.
Right. Sure.
They were all doing this 50s nostalgia thing, and you're just kind of like, oh, my God. So anyway, they do poke a lot of fun at that.
Mm-hmm.
With this band that is featured in different, well, actually they're featured as three different bands, but it's really the same band. First you have the 50s nostalgia band, the Juicy Fruits. Then you have the 60s nostalgia band, which he saw coming, because I don't think there was as much of a 60s nostalgia thing in the 70s.
No, no. Well, it was surf rock, was too, which I don't know if anybody was really that nostalgic for surf rock except for like Full House.
But he calls, you know,
the Beach Bums or something.
The Beach Bums.
Played by the same three guys.
Boys. Yeah, played by the same three guys. And then when they finally do open the Paradise.
And then it gets real interesting because.
The opening act, they become back as the Undeads. And
face painted, in corpse paint, sounding a lot
dancing,
like Bauhaus.
It's fucking guar. It's fucking, I mean, they're literally chopping off limbs and stuff like guar. That's guar's whole act.
Yeah. It was very, very goth in
right, it's
74.
Bauhaus. Right. I was like, did they do like a re-edit of this and come back with this?
Bauhaus formed in 78.
Yes.
And they are basically credited for inventing goth.
Right. This was just shocking. This really was.
And so, the Palma's musical Time Machine.
Right. So, of course, all hell breaks loose because Beef is the main act, and he does perform this song, and he has Phoenix as one of his background singers. When finally, of course, the Phantom makes good on his promise. And of course, kills him in the most dramatic fashion possible in front of the entire audience. And then they somehow convince Phoenix to come out to perform. Well, thinking that they're appeasing the Phantom, since he's threatened to not have her. And, you know, they're probably right. He probably would have laid the whole fucking theater to waste if she didn't.
Yeah. So I was waiting for her to sing something about cards for sorrow, cards for pain. Because that ending was the first show. That was the fourth. Yeah.
Yeah, it pretty much was. It was. It was the camera straight down.
Mm-hmm.
The world was spinning. Stop the world, I want to get off. Mm-hmm. That's the comeback line.
Yeah.
And hilarity
done
ensues.
A lot. God knows I've tried you.
Yeah.
So yeah, hilarity ensues. And again, that beginning with Serling, which blew my mind, because I had in my notes originally it was a hell of a Serling impression. And then I'm looking through Wikipedia. Wait, cameo from Rod Serling. Holy shit.
I'm like, yeah, that Serling thing was rough.
And
oh, that was him.
And then we get the first taste of the juicy fruits. Really made me wonder what we ever saw in Sha-Na-Na.
I just read a story not that long ago about Sha-Na-Na and Woodstock.
Mm-hmm.
And how it was actually Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, yeah.
That brought them in, and they had never really performed in front of anything larger than like a bar.
Uh-huh.
Like they'd never performed more than like maybe a few dozen people. And so they're out there at Woodstock with all these hippies just staring, going, "What the fuck?"
And it was because somebody canceled, but I can't remember who it was. Or somebody backed out of the show, and they needed to fill us.
Yeah, out. Might have been the Who.
It was somebody big.
Yeah, it might have been the Who actually.
But so, you know, they do that, and then we get Winslow singing one of his songs at a piano. Winslow becomes the guy who becomes the Phantom. And he's doing this Ray Charles head move, and it just goes on way too long.
Right. I'm kind of getting nervous here, because I'm like, you know, this is not going to be good. Like, I'm doubting this movie for a very long time. But see, one thing you can't deny about it, though, is that this is visually a really good-looking film.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it won me over in the next section, because, you know, Felbin, the business guy for Swan, pulls him aside and says, "We'd like to use your songs." And then we have Winslow trying to chase down Swan to work a deal out, and Swan's just giving him the complete brush off.
Yeah.
And it was the classic over-eager artist trying to get their song heard.
How about sneaking into a building
and everything.
Mr. Rainbow Connection's first line being the other F-bomb.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he's the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in drag, but, you know.
The overlapping voices when Winslow walked into the audition were a bit much. Because we have a bunch of prospective singers, female singers, performing his song. This is when he finds out it was stolen.
And yeah, I think that's kind of when I found myself being sucked in
mm-hmm.
to the actual plot and feeling for Winslow and yeah. just like, wow, okay.
So he gets ejected from the theater and thrown in jail. And again, they're going to pull his teeth to avoid an infection. He ends up with these metal teeth, escapes, gets disfigured in the record pressing plant, an actual record pressing plant, by the way.
Yeah,
it was
my
rigged
father
so it wouldn't hurt
those.
Him, but there was some kind of malfunction. I mean, obviously he didn't get disfigured, but it didn't quite work, didn't quite go to plan.
I believe my father worked with those back in the day.
Wow.
Yeah. I should ask him which record company he actually worked for, because it's a long time since I've heard the story.
Okay. And the effect after he got disfigured was really nice. Like the effects makeup.
Oh, yeah.
It looked great for 74. And then he emerges, and we just see his perspective, which, again, Raimi.
Yeah.
And we hear this heavy breathing, very Darth Vader.
Have we mentioned this was edited by Paul Hirsch yet?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Guy that did New Hope.
I thought we did that off the before we started.
Oh, okay, maybe it was off air.
We had too much of a conversation off air before this.
Yeah, yeah. I had some time to kill. But yeah, edited by the same guy who did New Hope.
So, and of course, De Palma, Lucas, Hirsch, I mean, they're all college film school buddies. Mm. You know, Coppola was in that crowd too.
Right.
So it isn't that crazy that some ideas kind of got passed around a bit. But I'll tell you, the moment that this film really won me over, and it's kind of like the scene in Lebowski where, you know, he says he hates the Eagles. So the Rolling Stone guy was mm-hmm. like, manager was like, I'm in, you can use it.
Right.
Was when the Beach Bums came out. Now, I was getting the feeling there that the satire was hitting a little too close to the bone. Like Ishtar had that whole, you know, it's a bomb, it's the worst movie ever. I think largely because of what it had to say.
Yeah.
And for them to skewer 50s nostalgia and then the Beach Boys and car culture, that was too much to ask of a middle American audience.
They rhymed registration and what was it? What was the rhyme with registration? I can't remember, but they actually were the registration and then like something about parole. Like the lyrics were just so ridiculously on point.
Yes.
I just wasn't sure about all the looking into camera. There are a lot of moments where the actors look straight into the camera in this movie.
Yeah, that was really, I mean, I don't understand the whole, like, filming, doing the exposition talk into the camera like that. Straight into the camera.
I mean, I kind of appreciate that they went there, but it was very unsettling, which I think is why they went there. Also loved when Swan was tweaking Winslow's voice. They end up working together. Obviously, Swan's going to screw him over again. But he's trying to, you know, help him recover from the incident and trying to fix his voice because he can't speak afterwards because his throat was pretty much crushed by the record pressing machine.
Yeah.
And he's got this black box on his chest and this black suit, and it's Vel Vader. But he's in this room with this organ singing this song. Incidentally, that was an actual studio that was filmed at the Record Plant in New York. I think it's in New York. Actually, I'm not sure if it's in New York or LA. Actual recording studio. All of those knobs were a custom-built synthesizer called Tonto, which still exists to this day. That wasn't just set dressing.
Wow. So, I mean, a synthesizer that looked like that back then. Damn. Mm.
That was a Moog. That Moogs were all patch cords, man. Or Moogs, sorry. By the way, De Palma considered Sean Anna for the Juicy Fruits, but he found them too difficult to work with and fired them. And rejected them.
This was much better, using the same band
all three. All absolutely. Three.
Yeah, I loved that.
But when he's, you know, tweaking Winslow's voice at the mixing board, if you know how a mixing board works, that's hilarious. I went to audio engineering school, so I know how all that works. And he's, you know, adjusting all these things, you know, horizontally across the board. That's not how they work. I think it was just a little subtle joke for people who actually know how to work a mixing board.
I mean, it's been a long time, and I think the mixing board I used back in, wow, we're talking like 30 years ago.
Yeah, years, that was a small little thing, but yeah, same principle.
Yeah.
You know, each vertical section is one track, is one thing that's coming in.
Yeah.
You know, if you go across horizontally, you're controlling another input. But he only had the one input he was messing with. hearing Swan's song played in multiple genres was interesting. Or Winslow, sorry. At one point, Swan is auditioning performers. This is where he finds Beef. And you're hearing the same snippet of the song played by a soul group and, you know, a doo-wop group and, you know, yada yada, onto a glam rock singer. And it was just interesting hearing the same song interpreted different ways. And I love the lyrics to the Phantoms theme, particularly the chorus. I can't remember the lyric. I should have put it in my notes, but all the good guys and the bad guys that I've been, you know, the angels and the demons. Right. Love that chorus. By the way, how did Winslow escape that electronic room to threaten Beef? Because he was walled in by Swan.
Well, there's the scene where they came back to the hallway to find the guards dead.
Oh, okay. I missed that.
Rick's just all on the floor. Mm. So he somehow just busted through that wall.
Okay.
They just didn't show him bust through the wall. Right, they just showed their after result.
They now, do here's skip the real over mystery. A few things.
The real mystery is how the fuck did De Palma get those shots with those mirrors without getting any crew in the mirrors.
Very carefully.
I mean, he did this multiple times, by the way, in this movie, where he did like head-on shots with mirrors in the background of the shot, and then I didn't see any crew.
No.
Not a single crew. And it was like he was daring us.
Yeah.
Because he did it then multiple times. I'm just sitting here each time he did it like, he did it again. What the fuck? He did it again.
And I love that the setting and the story allow it to be a musical without anybody singing for no reason.
Well, there were a lot of 70s musicals like that where it was, you know, in the music, you know, business. Like, what was the one, Get Crazy, we did?
Well, yeah, true.
Where everybody did Manish Boy.
But it's just nice because I'm not a musical person. And you know, having somebody sing their dialogue for no reason just annoys me.
We were just commenting that earlier in the week, how like the genre of, or the whole entire art form of opera is pretty much, you know, dead. Like dying in our lifetimes, along with, and you know, ballet too, but mostly opera.
And well, and at least opera, it's all sung. So at least the conceit is consistent. You know, with a musical, some of it's spoken, some of it's sung, and they sing for no reason, and it just never connected with me.
The dialogue sets up the song in between, but it's been done. There's some occasions where it's been done well, but yeah, for the most part, it's been done to death, you could say.
So at least the story and the setting of this movie sets up a reason for people to sing.
Then, of course, opera in itself is just like an athletic, insane thing. Like, just marveling at the ability of these people to belt out shit like that.
But much like orchestral music, it's becoming, it's considered a relic.
Well, the orchestra,
it's not kept fresh.
The orchestra can at least survive because it can be used in other art forms, yes, like film scores.
Mm-hmm.
That at least has that chance to do it. But
you know, as soon as, you know, with ballet, as soon as modern ballet happened, classical ballet was kind of on the way out.
But then dance altogether as an art form just, it doesn't exist like it used to, you know, and it's kind of sad to see that,
But we have the TV shows now.
The TV shows?
You know, So You Think You Can Dance and, you know, World Group, whatever the one with Jennifer Lopez was recently.
I don't know. Do those really save the art form
as
well?
But they're interesting. I like dance. I like watching it. I'm fascinated by any art form that I don't actually do, because I do quite a few of them. Hmm. So I have a particular respect for the ones I have no talent for. Anyway, back to Phantom of the Paradise. There's another nod to Rocky. I can't even say nod to Rocky.
We don't know if Rocky took from this.
Yeah.
We really don't know.
After they're leaving the theater after the show, Winslow gets Phoenix up on the roof of the ingenue and to try to tell her that Swan is going to take advantage of her and blah, blah, blah. And they have an argument. She goes back to the car. She tells them he's on the roof. And then there's a shot of the roof that looks exactly like the fucking Frankenstein place. And
even
then
sewing beef together, it was so magenta looking.
Yeah. Winslow's suicide attempt mirrors the opening song because it's about a guy who committed suicide to, you know, sacrifice himself to save a girl.
Yeah, he does a nice job of foreshadowing different things about, you know, the Faust, you know.
And then do we want to get to the twist? Do we want to reveal the twist?
I don't even know if I saw it as a twist.
Well, we find out that Swan actually is Faust.
Yeah.
He literally sold his soul.
And I mean, it's hinted to enough, you know, when they kind of come out and say it without saying it, revealing it fully when, you know, when the Phantom goes to kill him.
Right.
You know, and he
says, you find out there's something going on. I think he says, I have a deal with someone else or something.
I'm under contract. That's too. It, yeah.
So Winslow tries to kill himself. It doesn't work. It just seals itself up when Swan finds him and says, you know, as long as I'm alive, you're alive. As long as I have to be under contract, you're under contract.
And so you pretty much know how this thing is going to go down in the end.
Winslow finds the video of Swan actually selling his soul. Somehow the devil in the mirror showed up on film.
Hey, was it a video or was it a film?
It was a film, but yeah. It was actually real.
I was going to say, Brian De Palma's time machine does not extend to that kind of technology.
Well, no, it was it was video footage. You know, it was on a reel. I thought that whole thing was just beautifully campy because then they go to a bunch of other things that were apparently filmed for some reason.
Paul Williams looks a lot like Mickey Rooney.
Mm-hmm. And the whole last act was just this beautiful chaos.
Yeah.
Just this ridiculous, you know, glam rock song playing while just everything falls apart.
I mean, the Undeads, that's all you really need to know.
Well, this was after the Undeads. This was after he finds it.
You're right.
You know, just one song playing while he just, it was basically Swan's destruction. And of course, Winslow's, because they're connected in that way. I'm curious about why when Winslow's mask came off when he died, where was the makeup? Because he had this black makeup on, you know, under the mask to kind of hide himself.
And yet there was makeup on. I don't remember him with black makeup, though.
Yeah, whenever you saw him take the mask off, occasionally he had, like, black circles around his eyes and such to kind of darken his skin, you know, so you didn't see it behind the mask.
Maybe he just didn't get enough sleep that night.
Well, it's a common technique. I mean, if you've ever seen Peter Mayhew with the Chewbacca mask off, you know, he's got the black circles. And why was Phoenix so broken up about his death when they met like twice? They met at the audition when he first talked to her, and then when he pulled her up on the roof. That was it. They didn't like have a
connection.
They
do try to shoehorn a love story in somehow, don't they?
Yeah, I guess. I mean, it was more about his obsession with her, which, again, Phantom of the Opera, being obsessed with the singer, it was, you know. But she didn't, I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen the original Phantom, but she didn't really have any particular love for him, did she? I don't think so.
I thought there was kind of a seduction, maybe. You know, that she was intrigued by him,
okay, yeah,
of course.
But maybe there was, but he had more time, you know. She met Winslow, like, twice.
Right.
He died.
And that's true. In the Phantom of the Opera, I don't think she ever meets him before he gets disfigured. I don't think that
happens.
Right,
no. That's true. Yeah, she only sees him as the monster.
Yeah. Whereas maybe the Phantom was an improvement.
I really think this might be De Palma's best film.
Yeah, you know, if you told me a few years ago that Dress to Kill... But this, we would do both of these, and I would be like, "Oh yeah, Phantom would be much better than that." I would have thought you were crazy.
Yeah, like, even if you
Michael
told
Caine,
me that,
it's got...
if you told me I would hate Dress to Kill before I reviewed it, I would have said the same thing because I had very fond memories of the trailer and you know, little bits I'd seen here and there. Oh, by the way, Sissy Spacek was the set dresser on the film.
Which is, that's crazy in itself too, but yeah, she was in with that crowd too.
She was assisting her boyfriend at the time, Jack Fisk, who became her husband, who was a production designer. Yeah, she was a part of that whole scene. No sequels or remakes, and nor should there be. This needs to stand alone.
I could see this as a Broadway production.
I think it's perfect as it is.
Of course it is, but I think more people should see this anyway.
Yeah, fair point, yeah. Maybe a Broadway thing.
And
although,
you know, I don't know what, who, I mean, I don't think you need to do like a new music thing to it, you know.
No.
I think it works
yeah, so
in the genres they have.
Keep it as it is and just don't worry about the shocking prescience of De Palma.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think he saw far enough into the future where I would be faithful to this, mm-hmm. but seeing this live would be fucking crazy.
That's a fair point. Yeah, yeah.
especially if you stage have it right.
Winslow, if you stage the Phantom, like actually climbing around
with shit coming into the audience and stuff. Oh yeah. My god, this would be nuts.
And actually, you know, Winslow jumping around and climbing in the rafters while it's all going on. Yeah.
Exactly. Dancers going everywhere. Sure.
I loved it. I bought it. It's a 5 for me.
I was pretty much on the fence for a lot of it because, I mean, the story itself is kind of dicey and the acting is dicey.
It's Fast Beats Phantom of the Opera.
But god damn it, it is so beautifully shot. I mean, you don't expect a movie like this to be this beautifully shot, even if it is De Palma. Yeah. You're expecting something closer to Brie. And instead you get these tricks of like, I'm going to shoot a mirror head on and you're not going to see a camera or lighting guy or boom guy. It's a 4 for me. You got to see it. And just for the undeads alone. Mm-hmm. And then just keep saying to yourself, this was 1974.
This is like invented goth.
It's like a year after MASH debuted. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, like, what the fuck?
All right. So what have we learned?
We learned that De Palma had a time machine.
And I learned to never let my personal desires influence my aesthetic judgment. Although I think I've done that in the past. Anyway, that's it for Phantom of the Paradise. Until next time, probably next year. When we'll be reviewing, well, we have Zombie Cheerleading Camp slated, but if it's the beginning of the year, we got to do something big. We'll work that out ahead of time.
Yeah.
Until then, of course, always remember, never forget, wherever you go in life, there you are.
There you are.